So first of all, let's just explain where we are. So I've brought Juliet to come and speak to me about her new book, Slime, A History.
Yes.
And we're in All Hallows Church. And Ruth has got a little recording studio here and she lives here. And she's going to tell us a bit about the building.
It's a very old church. It was bombed during the Second World War. So now there are only some parts of it left. And then there's this kind of newer building that's kind of like attaches together bits of the old, bits of the original building. And then part of the original building is now just the garden. After the war, I'm not really sure what the purpose of the new bit of the building was originally.
Was it still a functioning church?
No, I don't. I'll have to find out when it was deconsecrated. So I've got my history of it. There's a big bit missing after the new bit was built. But then it was a recording studio in the 80s and 90s called Blackwing Studios, which is why a lot of the interior has this kind of double sound insulated doors, a lot of kind of breeze block sort of walls in between, separating the rooms and stuff. So it was a recording studio in the 80s and into the 90s. And it was quite kind of known for recording a lot of goth or sort of goth pop crossover kind of new romantic-y stuff. A lot of stuff on 4AD was recorded here. Stuff like Cocteau Twins and Depeche Mode. And still get occasionally you'll get some Depeche Mode fans in the garden, taking photos and stuff.
Amazing.
That's very good.
There's some really iconic photos of Depeche Mode when they were recording here that were taken in the garden. They've got the church part of it kind of in the background and stuff. And then people like Nine Inch Nails and the Pixies recorded here a little bit later on. I'm not sure when it stopped being a recording studio, but it was some point in the 90s, I think. And then it definitely was in a massive state of disrepair, and then it was squatted before we were here by some really kind of I don't know, had a big and not very positive reputation squatting
group. Right.
They were kind of serious anarcho nihilist crossing over into being just almost just crazy. I don't really know the exact best description of them, but they had all these a whole room full of just shit. I think it was very druggy. There's this massive mural which you can still see the outline of, which was like a woman's vagina with a load of sausages coming out of it that grew into a huge swastika covering all of the walls.
Oh, so no.
Quite a crazy.
So it's had
spot.
A really eclectic history, yeah. Then. And is it owned by Southwark Cathedral?
Yeah, so it's still officially owned by them. And I think after all, those squatters also causing a lot of trouble in the local area. They weren't very liked by this because there's it's a big housing association block kind of one side. And then we've got these sort of old listed cottages on the other side. And then there's some offices and stuff, but
because these are the back streets of Borough, right?
Yeah. Totally. So it's quite a weird area.
And it wasn't bombed in the war.
Restored? I've actually had a look. There's quite a good map in the Tate of where all the different kinds of bombs hit around London, and you can see this area is just
pretty much
decimated.
Yeah, totally.
Okay.
But it's quite interesting now because you can see a lot of social housing that was built after the war is where the bombs were, now there's just loads of flats. After that, I think the cathedral didn't know what to do with it, so they just handed it over to this co-op, and that's how we got it. On its criteria for who it prioritises, it has people coming out of squatting, which is quite a few people who live here kind of got it on those.
Yeah. Have there ever been any ghosts that you guys have seen? Is there any
because you are All Hallows, right?
Yeah.
It's the All Hallows Church.
So is there any kind of any
things that go
spiritual history of it or anything that you know about?
I don't really know. We definitely had, we just had the electrics redone on the whole building, and it used to be a lot of stuff was the fuse was blowing and the lights going out and stuff like that. And it's quite a dark building anyway, because it's especially after it was a recording studio, a lot of the spaces in it weren't built with any windows. Yeah. So, yeah, it can be... And there's the crypt right on the other end is always really cold and stuff. Although...
There's a crypt.
Yeah, that's...
I think we need to go and explore there later.
We can go and explore it.
Maybe here, though, I feel like...
That's why
all the loud music recordings maybe like that got rid of all the spirits.
Or maybe it's deconsecrated.
Nice, yeah, true.
That's it. Like, yeah. If it's been deconsecrated, then probably they've kind of left the building.
Yeah.
Wow. Are they floating around? Because this is an amazing area historically, right?
Yeah, I mean,
it's Marshall C. Debtor's Prison up the road. It's very kind of Dickensian. There's the... is it the prostitute's graveyard?
Yeah, this must have been like one of the night walking spots for like the really early like psychogeographers of London, right?
And even coming here today and going down the back streets, it isn't a gridded system. It isn't a modernist part of London, right? It's not like Regent Street where you have the flow. It's all these alleys and backways. It's the old medieval structure of London.
Yeah.
So as you're weaving through the streets... And you're thinking, where are they sitting? Where are these buildings? And so then turning the corner and suddenly coming to All Hallows Church, it's like, oh, there's a church in the middle of here. This is fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, this sipping coffee noise.
I think this is a very appropriate location.
I think it's really appropriate. It's a really good setting and a really nice way to lead into the conversation. So I think we should probably start-ish.
Sure. Maybe we should describe what we're sitting
on. We're sitting on a red
velvet
couch.
Velveteen. No, not just any kind of couch, Emily. This is a chaise lounge.
Okay, is it?
This is right. This is the most appropriate piece of furniture
for what we're about to discuss.
There's a Freudian element to it, right? But also the red velvet nature of it. There's a kind of decadence to it that's kind of good.
I really wish there used to be a red light in the tiny recording studio that we're in, but it is gone. But it's still got a good vibe. Yeah. So, first of all, I should say who I am and who you are.
That would be an excellent start.
So, I'm Emily. I work for Montez Press. I'm one of the editors there. And I am here with Juliette Christensen, Dr. Juliette Christensen.
Yes.
Got to get that in. And we work together at Goldsmiths. And I have heard through the grapevine that Juliette is writing a book about slime, which is called Slime, A History.
Yes.
Working title.
Yeah, working.
It's not a finished book yet, and I really wanted to speak to her for Montez Press Radio, a publishing house radio, about, I guess, her research journey so far. Okay. Where it's going. So I have a bio for you. I could read
Crib.
It. Or you could just introduce yourself, but...
Yeah. Shall I?
You go for it.
Okay. So my name's Juliette Christensen, Dr. Juliette Christensen. I'm a lecturer in design at Goldsmiths University, where I also lead the BA design programme. I am a design historian, a visual culture specialist, and I... investigate the intersection of the visual and the material and how those two come to mean. So I have a background in kind of philosophy and cultural studies and critical theory.
Very good. Okay, so to start with, I wanted to ask you kind of how you came to find slime as a subject. I think from the notes that you sent me, this has something to do with a new craze and obsession that maybe children are having around slime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it actually started with an invitation from Laura White, who's a senior lecturer in fine art at Goldsmiths. And she runs a website called Tenderfoot, which is around material investigations. And she'd heard through the grapevine that I had an interest in questions of materiality and invited me to contribute towards it. And as with all great invitations that come, I had absolutely no idea what I was going to write about. So I said yes initially, and then I started thinking about what might be an interesting topic, and the deadline got closer and closer and I had nothing, and the deadline got closer and closer and I still had nothing, and then the deadline got really close and I started looking around my house and seeing what kind of questions of materiality was I thinking of on a day-to-day basis. And the thing that I found was that my 11-year-old daughter had been obsessively making slime. And I hadn't been involved in this at all.
Making
slime.
Using what kinds of things?
Anything she could find in the house.
Okay.
And the reason I had discovered it is because she was making slime from various household things that she found around and putting them in bowls and then secreting them in different locations. So I would open...
To see if you would find them.
No, nothing.
Just a private experiment.
Yeah, just totally private. And it got to the state where I was cleaning something out from under the sofa and I pulled out a stack of magazines and there behind was a tiny little pot of slime. And I had been wondering where all my bowls were going.
Right.
And she had been making this and, like, dotting it around the house. And then I began to speak to friends of mine who had children of a similar age. And they, too, started telling me that their children were making slime. But our children didn't know one another. So then I was thinking, how are these children into this craze? And I started looking and watching. And it was through YouTube. They were endlessly consuming YouTube videos of slime making as kind of how-to guides.
Okay.
And then... in their homes, scouring for, like, various materials and experimenting with them and then taking them to school with their school friends and comparing the materiality and then coming home again and making another batch. And so this relationship between the digital and the material was super interesting to me. So in the end, that's what I wrote about for Laura White, this notion of what it means to have slime in my home.
Okay, so I have questions just off the back of that.
Yeah.
Who makes these YouTube videos? What's the aim? Like, is it to sell product or is it to, like, is it some kind of relationship to capitalism and anxiety and, like, a children's version of ASMR?
Yeah, I think it ties into the trend of ASMR, autosensory meridian response. I think in terms of the people who are making it, it's predominantly teenage girls.
And they can be, like, that you can, as, like, a YouTuber or as, like, an Instagrammer, yeah. I guess that's, like, a totally viable career option now, right?
Yeah, but then I don't even know if they're thinking about it in terms of becoming YouTubers or Instagrammers in terms of that. They've got into a certain... practice, I suppose, but these I think when they started, most of these young women are sort of 13-14 years old.
Okay.
So they're fairly young and they're making slime and then other younger children are watching it and picking it up and making it. And then it starts to kind of explode in this exponential I'm thinking now in terms of gender. I wonder how gendered it is. Well, that's not a question I've kind of explored.
Seems like a bit of a fuck you, no? To, like, the kind of Instagram culture of the highlighter and everything. If you're then instead making, like, something that's, like, a bodily ugly, like, traditionally...
Yeah.
...ugly, totally not to do... Well, it is to do with, like, it is to do with the physical body, but as it looks alien...
Yeah.
...to the body, so it's looking like... It doesn't look like a person in form.
But it doesn't do anything. This was the question that I found so interesting, right? It's not a question... Children's toys, this kind of trend that you have in crazes, we can date our childhoods through crazes, right?
Yeah.
So I think of, like... Cabbage Patch Kids. I'm a bit older than you.
No, I had that. They were a thing.
Yeah, they were a thing. What were other trends when you were growing up?
Aliens, like those little weird, like,
things.
Plastic aliens that you could get the alien pregnant. Tamagotchi pets. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a thing.
So you start to date your childhood and it becomes an exercise in nostalgia. But then with these current generation of children who are probably between 8 and 11 is really where the craze is sort of really major. Slime doesn't hold that kind of capital in terms of that objecthood, right? Like, you can go out into WH Smith or, you know, go to various places and buy slime, but it's not essentially owned or branded by anyone in that sense. There's a kind of pure materiality to it, which is almost anti-capitalist in a way, even as it circulates through YouTube and Instagram.
That's the bit where the anti-capitalism falls down, I guess, with this, like, quite, yeah, convenient, like, anti-production, like,
But it is production, because these children are, like, experimenting and making, and the notion that they're making with their hands and they're experimenting and they're getting stuff wrong, which is a really interesting thing around contemporary childhood, because certainly here in the UK there's this absolute paranoia around failure in childhood, and that slime becomes this material of experimentation is a super interesting kind of dialectic in a way. It is, as you say, it's a kind of fuck you. right? Like, yeah. I'm going to take hold of this and do this. And then each batch that my daughter was making, she was using slightly different recipes that she'd obviously found, so that the consistency of these materials were different in each batch, or they were differently coloured. So yeah. There was no uniformity. It was really about the heterogeneity of the encounter in each step, right? It's not the same object again and again.
Heterogeneity, now, what does that mean?
It's notions of kind of difference.
Okay. I always like to ask if I don't know what something means, because then it's easier.
No, as it goes forward. But each encounter is different.
Okay.
So some consistencies of these slimes were like soup, you know, like really soupy, and others were like she'd put bits in it and it was really... And so... You know, this absolute fascination with materiality from a generation that were born maybe in 2010.
God.
Yeah. Like, they are post-internet kids.
Yeah.
They are total post-internet kids. And yet there is this attention to materiality, okay, which for me was the really interesting thing.
So that, I guess, situates us very much within the present moment.
Yeah.
And slime. I think, did you have a song that relates particularly to that in your list?
Yeah.
Okay, do you want to... So I've asked Juliet to pick a few songs, a little bit like Slime Desert Island Discs or something, right? And each of them relate to an area of the book that she's researching and writing. So what would the song be for this?
Well, this song comes out of BuzzFeed News, and it's by an ASMR artist.
Okay.
And what he has done is he's taken tiny snippets of ASMR sounds, so stroking paper and things, and he's composed a kind of song using all these different sounds as samples.
Okay.
Hello there. As you can see, we're set up for an ASMR video, but today we're going to try things a little differently. Stick with me. Tape. A pen. Scissors. This is just like a little air blower thing. I've got a notebook. I've got about 46 cents in coins. Okay, I think we've got some really good sounds. I'll be right back.
That's ASMR. I feel calmer.
Do you?
I actually do. I've never like fully listened to any ASMR all the way through. I've always just been like, oh no.
But again, ASMR is really interesting because it is so connected to questions of materiality, right? The noise of scissors or something like this. And yet it is mediated through YouTube. It's mediated through the digital, yes. Right? You don't go to live ASMR events, as far as I'm aware. It's all done through podcasts, YouTube videos, Instagram, these kind of things. There is a mediation that happens through it.
Yeah.
And yet this is meant to assuage our anxiety. An anxiety caused by one of the drivers, social media.
Exactly. So you know, it's just feedback and capture, and so like it's a drive, isn't it?
Yeah.
But okay, so we've got the present, and I think we should talk about the past.
Okay.
So there's I phoned you the other day, and in my mind, when I phoned you were in a secret library, secret library location, and you were examining. And was it ectoplasm that you were supposedly, well, that supposed ectoplasm that you were actually examining?
Yeah.
And this had been secreted from, again, supposedly from, was it from Helen Duncan?
Yes, it's actually? Helen Duncan.
Okay, so for people who don't know who Helen Duncan is, she was a medium around the First World War.
Yeah.
Time.
Post-World War.
And then she was the last person to be convicted under the Witchcraft
Act. Yeah.
Had a huge following. Used to do lots and lots of seances, bring back soldiers, like speak to dead soldiers.
Yeah.
Wartime kind of phenomena. And no one could work out where this ectoplasm was coming from. But can you maybe, like, I've gone really far in. So yes. Can you maybe backtrack and explain a little bit around this subject?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the history of spiritualism. I've had a long-standing research interest in spiritualist practices, predominantly in the 19th century. But with ectoplasm, this was a chance to kind of move my research forward into the 20th century. Because interestingly, ectoplasm, I've been searching and searching for the first appearance of ectoplasm, and the earliest I can find any kind of dated recordings is around 1902. So okay. It's very much a 20th century phenomenon. And when you think that spiritualism itself began much earlier with the Fox sisters in Hydesville, Pennsylvania, which is kind of mid 19th century. So it'd been going for like 50 years as a practice before ectoplasm appears on stage.
Okay.
And then it's really post World War One where ectoplasm takes centre stage and becomes one of the kind of dominant ways in which spiritualism is practiced. And Helen Duncan is one of the key figures in the kind of birth of ectoplasm. I mean that kind of metaphorically and literally. And it's this piece of ectoplasm when you rang me.
Yes.
That I went to go and meet.
I'm in the library.
Yeah.
I was like, right, sounds like a good day.
It was a really good day. It was a really, really good day. It's the only piece of ectoplasm that I found in an archive in the UK. I'm not sure if there are other pieces of ectoplasm that exist in other archives. But no, I had read about this piece of ectoplasm and wanted to meet it in person.
So what is the definition of ectoplasm? Like, what is that? Like,
where does it come from?
Yeah.
Well, the word itself is a biological term, and it comes from, if you remember, GCSE biology.
So sadly, I did not pass, but yes. Don't tell anyone because I've got jobs.
Yes, on the basis of this.
Yeah.
But if you have it's part of an amoeba. You know, you have endoplasm and ectoplasm, and the ectoplasm, if I remember my biology correctly, is the part of a cell which kind of helps the cell physically move forward.
Okay.
It's the kind of that you have the nuclei in the middle that is the kind of brain center, and then you have the kind of liquid that moves it through. And so actually there were other words that were used for ectoplasm, so they called it teleplasma to begin with.
Okay.
But it's meant to be a materialization of the spirit world.
Okay.
So spiritualist practices, so beforehand,
it's a ghost.
Well, no, not really.
Or like a sort of a ghost. A trace of a ghost?
Yeah. I mean, it can. I was reading some stuff in preparation for talking to you today, this morning,
okay.
about Conan Doyle talking about ectoplasm.
Yes.
And he very much talks about it in terms of it kind of appearing out of the body of the medium.
Yeah, okay.
And then kind of disappearing back again. And he talks about occasions where they've captured a piece of ectoplasm and they've kept it in a box, but then it dissipates and kind of disappears and is no longer there for further examination. Because Conan Doyle was a member of the Society for Psychical Research, which is okay. the archive I was in.
Yes.
Looking right. at the ectoplasm, which is actually based at Cambridge University.
Okay.
In their big library. So you go into Cambridge with all the kind of Harry Potter-esque kind of atmosphere that Cambridge yeah. has, walk through its streets, end up in this huge library which holds everything because it's one of the repository libraries. And then I think I was in the manuscripts room and calling up boxes from the archives, and then this box appeared on my desk with just this note, a grey archival box that just said, ectoplasm, Helen Duncan, medium.
And what, I mean, to me, it's I because there's all the theories, aren't there, of like what this actually could have been.
Yeah.
But
or
what
is.
Or is, you know. So what did it look like?
Well, this
to
is the
you?
Thing.
Like, what did it look like to you?
So I'm going to go back a bit. So the box okay. appeared on my okay. desk. And I have been wanting to see it for so long.
Mm.
And I was incredibly excited that this object, like in total kind of geek historical mode, that this box had appeared on my desk. And the handwriting was so meticulous. And, you know, it was part of this archive of the Society of Psychical Research, which itself was part of the archive of Cambridge University. And so I was really struck by this kind of tiny box and its huge systems in which it sits. And I spent a good 40 minutes wrestling with the idea of whether to open it or not.
Okay.
There was a large part of me that didn't want to open it.
A bit like Don't Meet Your Heroes.
Yeah, a bit like yeah. I don't want to know.
Yeah,
I don't
okay.
want to know what's in it. It's enough that it's here and it's in yeah. an archive and it's labelled ectoplasm, which ties into another idea. Because if you look up this item in Cambridge University, they have a photograph of it. And the photograph is, I can show it to you later, the photograph is of this kind of white form that if it's dancing. So it looks very much like in early film, there was a kind of trope that a lot of filmmakers did at the end of the 19th century, which is called the butterfly dance.
Okay.
Have you ever seen this piece of film?
No.
So it's a woman normally wearing a large white dress and she's sweeping it kind of backwards and forwards and it's incredibly beautiful. And what the early filmmakers did is they hand-coloured the film so that it looks like a butterfly changing colour constantly as it shifts and moves.
Wow.
It's a really extraordinary piece of filmmaking. And, yeah, very, very super early. Anyway, the photography of this piece of ectoplasm that Cambridge University have done, you have no sense of scale. There's no sense of material. It looks like this kind of shifting white form.
Oh, really?
So there's a sense that even in communicating what is in this, Cambridge University is sort of keeping the door slightly shut. So I'm really hesitant about actually talking about what I found in the box.
Okay, well, you don't need to tell me. Maybe we leave it as a mystery.
I think the question of, like, how you engage with objects in an archive is a really interesting one, specifically when you're talking about trying to engage historically.
Yeah.
Like, what are the contemporary... I will tell you this, though. I was very careful in noting down, as I was interacting with the object, what it felt like and the kind of materiality of the encounter, the heterogeneity of the encounter, like what it was, the space I was in, what other researchers were doing at other tables, what I was doing, whether anyone was watching me.
I bet people were watching you.
What...
Surely everyone knows.
Because everyone was looking at manuscripts.
Surely
like
this
medieval
is like the big deal thing to get.
Not sure. But then I took the object that I found, put it back in the archive, and I had known a little bit and read a little bit about how ectoplasm had been excreted.
Vagina.
Predominantly, yeah.
Yeah, and now... Because it has all these kind of like connotations of like orgasm or like invisible pleasure of the woman and kind of like not non-measurable pleasure. I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud.
No.
But like it seems to me to have connotations that are like that or kind of like female ejaculation
yes.
is something that we don't know if it exists or not. And then there's this ectoplasm that's coming from women or mediums and we don't know if it exists or not and what it is.
And various orifices. So not just the vagina, but like different parts of the female body. I've only found a couple of examples that where ectoplasm was produced by men. It's predominantly it's women.
Normally women.
And the photographs are extraordinary when you look at them because these women, it clearly looks like they're in pain at the moment of kind of ejaculation, at the moment that this ectoplasm is produced from their bodies.
It's a painful.
Their physical body is kind of writhing and their facial expression is one of kind of extreme pain, as if it takes them extreme effort to do this. The majority of mediums, certainly in the 19th century and throughout the 20th century, have been women. It's been a womanly performance. It's the woman's body as a vessel. Right? To carry the spirit through from the other world into the real world or our material world. And so when you get into the 20th century and women's bodies aren't just channeling spirits in terms of kind of speaking voices, which is the kind of famous thing of mediums, articulating the voice of the ghost, but they're actually physically producing material that is meant to demonstrate that the spirit world is real. And yet in that moment of producing it, their entire bodies are kind of, they're just, image after image is just a woman in pain producing this kind of whitish material. And they produce it from their breasts, from their ears, from their vaginas.
Yes, I've heard about the ears.
Yeah.
That's quite a good one.
Yeah. The ghosts come in everywhere, right? But it's like if the ectoplasm is some kind of proof of the ghost world and that it's produced from these orifices, you're like, well, if that's where it comes out, where does it go in?
Yeah.
Like, you know, how is that established within spiritualist practice? And what I notice so much in our conversation that we're having, we're not talking about whether this is real or not.
No.
Because I don't think that's the interesting question.
Okay, that's interesting, because I always wonder about whether these things are real or not. But then I guess there are so many different lines of, like, the hoax that you can... I watched this terrible Tony Robinson from Time Team program that investigated Helen Duncan, and he went to see an expert who staged how it could be done.
Yes.
In terms of, like, the lighting and having other people involved and like filling rooms with smoke, etc., etc. And I was just quite upset after I watched it because I was like, oh, well.
And also it doesn't get to the root cause of historically why these practices were...
No, exactly.
...were happening.
Yeah.
Because they didn't appear out of nowhere, to use a kind of crappy phrase. Mm. They didn't appear out of nowhere. They had a long history and they were performed and very well attended.
Yes.
And women performed these acts for a reason, you know. And that for me is the more interesting question about whether it's true or not, or whether the spirit world exists.
Why were they doing it?
No, not at all. But the types of bodies and the types of performances that were enacted and the types of audiences and the whole kind of question around materiality, spirituality, consciousness, free will, those are the more interesting questions for me to look at, which seems a strange thing when I talk about I'm writing a book about slime, right?
Because
there's a sense that I'm just writing a book about slime, but I find slime to be this fascinating material through which I can start exploring kind of philosophical questions.
It becomes a vessel in itself, doesn't it,
to start looking through
different individual but also interlinking research interests that you have. Do you have a song that relates particularly to the ectoplasm?
I do.
Or to spiritualism, mediumship, all these different things?
I found a piece of music that I think would be excellent to accompany this. So this is Ruth White. White was an early pioneer of electronic music, and she produced an album around Charles Baudelaire's Fleur de Mal.
Okay.
And this is called Litanies of Satan.
Oh, wow.
Thank you. most beautiful angels. God betrayed by destiny and shorn of praises. O prince of exile who has suffered injustice and who in defeat grows ever stronger. You who know all, great king of the underworld, ancient healer of human anguish, you who even to leopards and accursed outcasts teach us through passion the taste for paradise. Oh, you who through your old and powerful mistress death begot that charming insanity, oh, you who give the outlaw that serene and haughty smile that damns an entire nation thronging round the guillotine. You who know in what corners of the greedy earth the jealous god hid precious stones. You whose bright eye knows the deep arsenals where slumbers the race of metals. You whose vast hand guards the sleepwalker from the precipice as he strays on the brink of lofty buildings. You who by magic make supple the bones of the old drunkard trampled beneath hoofs of horses. You who, to console man in his suffering and weakness, taught us to mix saltpeter and sulfur. You who placed your mark, O subtle occultus, on the forehead of the vile and the pitiless rich. You who turn women's hearts and eyes to the cult of the wounded and the love of rags. Staff of the exiled, lamp of inventors, confessor of the hanged and of the conspirators, adoptive father of those whom in his black rage God the Father drove from the earthly paradise. Satan, have pity on my lost misery.
Thank you.
So we're going to move on, I think, and talk about the last sections of, well, not last sections, the last two sections of the book. So you're going to have part of this that's talking, looking at toxic forms.
Yeah.
Right. In terms of how slime as toxic waste played a role in the birth of the modern environmental movement.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also through its appearance in post-war cinema.
Yeah.
So could you, this will be really interesting to me to hear a bit more about this and how these two things are interlinking from your perspective.
When I chose the subject of slime, I could obviously situate it in the contemporary really, really easily. And obviously with my daughter's experiments and then also looking at ectoplasm, it seemed to sit in kind of early 20th century. And I was thinking, where else does slime appear between those two moments? Like, what's the trajectory that slime follows through the 20th century? And one of the kind of first visual images that came to my mind were the opening credits of the film The Blob.
Okay.
And the notion of kind of slime typography.
Yes.
That you see around all the time. And then I started thinking a little bit more and kind of looking at sort of post-war cinema, and particularly B movies, with monsters and kind of science fiction films, really kind of low budget things, like The Blob and Slime People and things, and thinking about what the time period in which this happened. So it's obviously the birth of the kind of Cold War era, so there's the notion of the big other, but that also the notion that slime or slimy materials then become toxic. There is a toxicity to them, totally threatening, which is after the period when, you know, nuclear bombs have been dropped for the first time. Exactly. So the notion of the annihilation of the human race
really starts to become extremely tangible.
Extremely tangible. And the notion of toxicity and kind of chemical waste. So the notion of maybe in the 20s and 30s, science is seen as this great kind of technocratic liberation of humanity. Mm-hmm. And then you have the nuclear bomb, and then there becomes this kind of fear about where science is taking us and what it is doing. And I put science in sort of inverted commas in that. And then you start seeing kind of toxic waste films appear again and again and again. And this ties into questions around environmentalism, which you see rising in the 60s and 70s with various kind of environmental disasters. And then you start in the 70s, start getting things like the Clean Air Act and legislation. Governments start to put in legislation to try and protect the environment. So that chapter, which I'm still kind of working on because I'm still watching lots of films and reading quite a lot about environmentalism, is really about tracing that relationship between the representation of toxicity on our screens that happened in cinema and in TV, and then how that tied into kind of the social and cultural movement to protecting our planet.
Okay.
Which I think is rather timely, given that we are in a climate emergency.
The state that we are in.
Yeah. But there are like some horrendous stories. There's a horrendous story I read about a place near Niagara Falls, which was a big driver towards environmental legislation being put in the US, where an entire suburb had been built on a toxic waste site. And the families who lived there had been battling with the authorities for maybe 15 years.
Oh, that's like a really common American story, isn't it? Yeah. Like Erin Brockovich is based entirely around that. That's the whole premise of the film. Also a true story.
Also a true story.
But there are consistent like lawsuits in America based around this, aren't there? Typically affecting extremely poor communities.
Yes, and this is exactly what it was in terms of city planning. This town was built on a toxic waste site that had been established in the 20s and 30s, and then in the 40s they'd built this suburb, and these families literally had toxic waste bubbling through the basements of their houses for about 15 years. It was a huge public health problem. Most pets in the area got cancers and died very young. There was a high rate of miscarriage, and there was a high rate of children being born with deformities. This went on for maybe 15, 20 years and nobody picked it up. And you'd kind of read these stories and think, how didn't anyone not notice these huge health problems that this particular area had? And so then the kind of visual image I have in my head of these kind of American homes all situated with bubbling toxic waste like creeping up out of their cellars is one of absolute horror, and that no one did anything, which is for me slightly the more horrifying thing. Yes. That it wasn't spotted, that it wasn't. And but then maybe that points towards a kind of cultural discourse around what toxicity is.
Very good. So do you have the song that we've listened to earlier that is very, very relevant to this topic because it's from a film that you were talking about at the beginning? Yeah.
So rather delightfully, it's from The Blob. It's the theme song, which I believe is composed by Henry Mancini. It's one of his early compositions. And for a kind of 1950s horror sci-fi film.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
That means very, very excellent PDF of Against Interpretation, which for just a note for anyone, if you want to read something brilliant, The Imagination of Disaster, which is the, I don't know, how many pages is it?
It's not very long.
It's not very long, and it covers a kind of a really good breakdown of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Really good breakdown of sci-fi and how that operates according to Sontag. So, yes. Very
but particularly those kind of B movies of the 50s and 60s and the tropes, and what she does so beautifully is like trace out the kind of storytelling schemata around it and then talks about how it ties into contemporary notions of the 50s and 60s about what science does in culture and how we understand it. And it's very what did you call it earlier, dry?
It's beautifully dry, but really she's always dry. Just so beautifully dry, you just read it and you can hear the humour.
Yeah.
You can hit, which I love in academic
and she also
writing.
Talks about things that are like, this is hilarious. Like she writes a few times towards the end, like when the hero says this is hilarious.
I know. And you think, I think she's wonderful. What the fourth track, what is that in relation to?
Nickelodeon,
which leads us, perhaps quite well to the last section, no?
Yeah, which is the most underdeveloped.
Okay. What would you like to talk about within this section the most?
Well, if we're tracing a trajectory, shall I just go for the recording? In terms of tracing a trajectory, so what happens to slime after the birth of the environmental movement?
Okay.
So, like, if we take the birth of the environmental movement, sort of 60s, 70s, into the early 80s, what happens to slime in the 80s and 90s? And so when I was thinking about that period of the 80s, 90s, maybe early 2000s, the visual image I had was of people getting slimed on children's TV. which is Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon becomes the kind of owner of slime in this way. And slime, which is this toxic material in the 50s, 60s and 70s, to which people have got this kind of abject response, right? Of, ugh, slime, it's going to hurt us. And then suddenly people are sitting there having slime thrown on them. And so that shift of the cultural meaning of it was really interesting. So that's the thing I'm trying to work on at the moment of thinking about what does slime mean in that historical period, the kind of end of the Cold War, the beginning of sort of neoliberalism, the individual
the 90s
child.
the 90s television slime.
Early 2000s, where there were these big arena events for the Nickelodeon kids, and celebrities would stand up and be slimed.
Okay, and I guess that's also, it's very like, it's not like Americana, but it's very American.
Yeah, it feels very American.
Very American, that.
Although
whole...
I think it happened on a programme called Tiz Was, I think, in the 80s.
Okay, and that's like a British programme.
That's a British programme, and were a few British programmes where people got slimed.
Interesting. Oh, and also, what was that children's show on a Friday? Oh no, this is going to bug me forever.
You got to work it out.
It was like a Gunge program.
Yeah, you see Gunge.
Yeah, no, and it was like a. Oh my god, this is. I'm gonna have to think about this.
The one that I've recently remembered from the 80s was Fungus the Bogeyman, which is like Where the Wind Blows. Did you ever remember Where the Wind Blows?
No,
which
I
was about
a
nuclear. William Briggs, the illustrator.
Okay.
He also did a series called Fungus the Bogeyman.
Okay.
Which again is something that I'm trying to work out and have a think around.
No, there was a show on a Friday, and it was like and there were two contestants. It was a children's show, and you'd have to go in a Gunge like wrestling ring,
right?
And it was presented
by two young men.
Yeah, and it was presented by some like cool young presenters. It wasn't like Ant and Dec, but it was
I know who Dick and Dom.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, but it was really famous, and I used to watch it. On Fridays
after
school.
But why did we
school?
Watch it? This is the question I'm still asking. Like, why did slime move from that meaning of being toxic?
I guess it's like humorous humiliation became something that we really enjoyed.
Yeah.
Or like wanted
but
to
consume.
But why
that material? Like, we can humiliate people in all kinds of ways.
That's
why
like a child-friendly way to humiliate. There's lots of ways that you can humiliate that aren't child-friendly.
Yeah, that is true. But then the kind of green gunkiness of it as well. I think of, when you talk about humiliation, I think of kind of Japanese game shows where the levels of humiliation are just incredible.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know about these shows.
Oh, no. they take it to a whole other level. But and so, you know, slime seems completely kind of innocuous in that situation. But I'm wondering about the kind of birth of sort of neoliberal childhood, whether
that
occurs.
To...
And there's a kind of garishness, and there's a Nickelodeon is very kind of orange and bright green, and there's a kind of popness to it.
Yeah, no, this is a good, really interesting.
And so how does that kind of metabolise in a political sense?
Okay. Well, I think that's quite a good question to not to end on, but you have another song
a final song
where? So we'll go with that, and then
so as I'm trying to work out what Nickelodeon means,
a big question,
this is the theme song to Slime. Notice it when you're watching it, because it's a video and it's loads of people getting slimed.
So
I've ripped this from a YouTube video.
Lyrics.
Yeah. But not at all.
All right.
Should we close?
I think we should close. I thought that was... Thank you very much for speaking.
No, thank you for having me.
So lovely.
I do go a little bit Radio 4.
I do think I do goo. No. When there's a mic in the room, I
not
do goo.
Really not at all. I thought it was fascinating and really pleased to have you on Montez Press Radio.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
And I really look forward to reading this wonderful exploration of slime and all the subject it traverses. In the next year? 2 years?
Yeah.
Next year?
Yeah. Okay. Let's see how it works.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. Thank you, Emily.
Thanks.